That's Genesis 42, verses 1 to 25. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy again for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." He said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the son of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. But this you shall be tested, by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them.
The second reading is just a couple of pages over on page 38, chapter 45, verses 1 to 15. Chapter 45, verses 1 to 15. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for your remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children, and your children's children, and your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you have seen. Hurry and bring my father down here.' Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him."
Well, let me add my welcome to Tom. It's great to see you here this morning. And thank you very much indeed for joining us. My name is Chris, part of the leadership team here at St. Nick's. And I was at that dinner party that we were hearing about earlier from Christian. And I'd like to say everything he said was true, but there were a few extra details that he decided to leave out. So if you'd like me to fill in the gaps, do come and speak to me afterwards. Some entertaining details, which I may make public another time. Anyway, let's keep our focus on Genesis 42 to 45. I think this is the longest Bible passage that we tried to deal with here at St. Nick's in our 5 years of existence. We're going to have a go at it in one go. We only heard the beginning and the end read. There's a big bit in the middle that I'm going to sort of skim through as we go. I think it's really important to read these chapters together because I think they form a unit in the narrative. And so we're going to take the whole lot together. In terms of where we're heading, well, I think the whole thing contributes to our understanding of God at work in this world. You'll see that on the handouts, the main idea right there at the top. God is at work for his people, despite the chaos of life. For the last three chapters up until this point, we've been with Joseph. First, as a slave in Egypt, we followed his downfall. Do you remember he was falsely accused? He went to prison. And then his rise to power, Lord of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. Chapter 41 ended with the news that famine had begun. There was no food anywhere except in Egypt, and so it's a perfect time to catch up with what's going on with Jacob and all the family back at home. So chapter 42, where we began today, begins with a sort of, meanwhile, back in the promised land, Jacob and all of the sons, they're starving. And so we start this episode of Joseph with a crisis. And it's a serious one. I mean, famine back then in the ancient world was a killer. You had very little chance of surviving. God's people are facing certain death. By the end of the section, well, crisis has been quelled. And the story ends with a sort of organized fun and laughter and plenty of food. I mean, it sounds like a St. Nick's church weekend away, doesn't it, at the end? So there we go. Now, how does this whole turnaround come? Well, God uses his man, Joseph, to do it all. He functions as the sort of savior of his people. He is the Christ figure, if you like, in typological terms. Despite being rejected by his family, he was sold for 20 pieces of silver. He rises to great power. He's able to make decisions which function to save God's people, his own family, from certain death. Here is God at work for his people, despite the chaos of life all around. Now, if I'm right, that's the big idea, then all the details in this sort of big chunk of narrative should contribute to our understanding of that big point. I think this is a really important point to grasp in terms of Bible handling. I'm sure we're reading narrative. I mean, these are events that really happened. We can go with the brothers through the ups and downs and sort of experience what it was like as we read the narrative. But importantly, remember, the narrative is a selection of events. Moses, who wrote this book, selected the right events to make points, points about God, who he is, what he does, and how he operates in this world. And so we need to keep our eyes on the main thing as we appreciate the details. 42 to 46 in Genesis exposes the sovereign work of our God, even though there are major problems in this fallen world. And even though his people have a track record of making particularly bad decisions along the way, again and again, they mess up. I'll walk us through a few of the details in our time together. Fill in a few of the gaps from the middle bit, which I guess not everyone will have had a chance to look at. And I'll finish by asking, so what for us as readers today? You'll see the first point on the handout there. The life-threatening problem is solved by God alone. The life-threatening problem solved by God alone. Now, a right grasp of the Christian faith today starts with accepting this big idea. It's laid down for us in the Bible at this stage, and it repeats many, many times. Problem, solution. Ultimately, the gospel is problem, solution. God alone solves the problems that humanity face. Let's dive in. Look back to 42 verse 1. I'm going to sort of walk us through a few of the verses. Some we've heard read, some we won't have heard read. 42 verse 1, that's where we began. When Jacob learned there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" I love the picture. You can almost sort of see the entertaining side of this. The brothers are all staring at each other, sort of saying, "Well, go on, then if you're so clever, you go and find some food to eat." Well, Dad has something to say, verse 2. And he, that is Jacob, said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." You can see, it's binary. It's as simple as that. And it helps us to understand, I mean, this isn't just a shortage of luxury goods. Life and death is on the cards. And that has big implications for us as readers, because, of course, God had promised to Jacob that he would be blessed. And in fact, lots of the promises that God had made to Abraham were then repeated to Jacob. Stars in the sky, sand on the seashore type of language. If he and his sons all die, well, it's going to look like either God doesn't care or God isn't powerful to do anything about it. And so the stakes are very high. God's integrity is in the balance. Well, flick forward a couple of pages, chapter 45, verse 9. This is the sort of the grand reveal. Joseph takes his disguise off, and he's talking to his brothers. Look at verse 9. "Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me. You and your children and your children's children and your flocks, your herds and all that you have, there I will provide for you. There are yet 5 years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have do not come to poverty.'" There's the happy ending. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? Certain death in Canaan, in the promised land. Ironically, life, salvation, figuratively speaking, in Egypt. The promise of food, protection, life. How is this problem solved? Just in case you miss it, we get it three times in the narrative. Look at verse 5. So chapter 45, verse 5. "And now, says Joseph, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Who brought this about? God did. Similar point in verse 7. "And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors." And just in case we're in any doubt, or just in case we were sort of zoning out for those two, look at verse 8. "So it was not you who sent me here, but God." You see, when it comes to saving people, God alone, not God with our help, is at work. He is the one with the ultimate eye on all the details. He is the one that solves the unsolvable-looking problems in our world. And I think it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, that God makes it all possible through the sinful, ridiculous actions of the brothers. They intended evil. They intended evil. God used it for good. And that's an important theme of the Joseph narrative. And the author will return to that. That builds to the climax. Tom has alerted us to that. It sort of builds through the section, and we will get there in a few weeks' time. But for now, I don't think that's where the force of the narrative goes. You see, most of the rest of the details in our passage focus on the changed lives of the brothers. And so, yeah, problem, solution. But now let's home in and see what actually happens along the way to the family of dysfunctional brothers, what we're going to see is a change takes place. There's a change both on the horizontal. The dysfunctional family, well, regains a little bit of their dignity, shall we say. But there's also a change on the vertical. And that will sort of unfold in parallel to all of this. They become convicted of their sin. They realize they're accountable to God. All of this unfolds in the middle of the story. So that brings us to the second point. The brothers' lives are changed along the way. I think the turnaround, the transformation, is quite stunning at many levels. Now remember, the famine prompted Jacob to send his sons into Egypt for food, and they all go, this time, without Benjamin. They arrive in Egypt, and we catch up with Joseph. Have a look at verse 6. Sorry, we're back in chapter 42 now. 42, verse 6. Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. That should ring bells for us as readers. They bowed with their faces to the ground to Joseph. Do you remember the dreams that we went into in previous chapters? The dreams are being fulfilled. For us as readers, this is God at work. Don't worry, we're being told. Now, the brothers, of course, are clueless at this point. They've got no idea that Joseph is even alive. All they can think about are their rumbling tummies. Joseph, on the other hand, well, he recognizes his brothers, but he decides to stay disguised. And he uses the opportunity to test his brothers. He calls them spies. Look at verse 11. They protest. "We," they say, "are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." Now, for Joseph to call them spies is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Consider the backdrop again. There is famine, life and death situation. If you were a surrounding nation to Egypt and you realized that Egypt had food, you wouldn't just send in the army. The first thing you'd do is send in spies. Joseph was alert to this. He was looking out for spies. That's what that sort of reference to the nakedness of the land. Spies would be sent to find the unprotected parts of the land. Joseph decides to design a test for his brothers. Have a look at verse 15. "By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." Well, the tables have turned. Now it's the brothers' integrity that is in the balance. They may not be spies looking to steal, but they've claimed to be honest. And they've claimed to be honest men before Joseph. And that's a bit of a mistake, isn't it? I mean, not only to claim the moral high ground is always going to be a little bit dangerous, but to claim that you're honest in front of a brother that you've treated in the way that they treated him, well, it probably struck a pretty raw nerve for Joseph. Just remember, I mean, back in chapter 37, they planned to kill Joseph initially. In the end, they sort of compromised and chucked him into a pit. At the last minute, they modified their plans and sold him into slavery. And then they went home and they lied to their father and said that his son, Joseph, was dead. It's not particularly honest, is it? Joseph knows all this, of course, and so he chucks them in prison for 3 days, no doubt, to get them thinking over their lives. A little bit of self-reflection, especially in the matter of honesty. It never hurt anyone. And I guess there's just an opportunity to pause and to think about that for a moment. I mean, just think about the things that we say about ourselves or write about ourselves or post about ourselves, words that cover up, words that mislead or distract. It's so easy, isn't it, to portray ourselves in a way that we want people to see or we know perhaps isn't completely true. And when we see it happening in the story, it sort of annoys us. We're alerted to it. We know it's true in our own lives. We quickly brush over that. We can see the hypocrisy of the brothers. And we don't have to search far to see it in ourselves. And I think these little details are designed just to sort of reflect back on us every now and then and just to challenge the reverse. As we see hypocrisy, are you aware of hypocrisy? And we make the error of thinking that God doesn't know and God doesn't care. And I'll come back to that at the end, but it's just worth, I think that's how these details function along the way. Back to the brothers. I mean, they're in prison. They'd had the taste of prison just 3 days. Remember, Joseph had been in prison for 13 years. And Joseph knows he can't keep them for long because, of course, the backdrop is famine. It had taken the brothers 7 days to get to Egypt. He can't keep them too long. His father's going to die because they don't have any food back home. It's 7 days back home. It's 3 days in prison. He realizes he's got to take them out. So he speaks to the brothers, verse 18, 42:18. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God." That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? "I fear God," says Joseph. You should be fearing God by implication. Brothers, readers, Joseph fears God. Verse 19, "If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. And as the test becomes clearer to them, well, so their conviction of their own sin begins to grow. Have a look at verse 21. "Then they said to one another, 'In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother.'" That's a big thing for them to admit. "In that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why distress has come upon us." Well, perhaps in a tiny way, that time in prison, I mean, of course, the tables are turned. They're getting a taste of their own medicine. Remember, they had done to Jacob what we've recently witnessed. We get reminded about all the time in the news, don't we? I mean, think about what those child abductors did to the McCain family. That's what they had done to their father. Joseph denied the life of the family, snatched from his father's care, and their guilty consciences are beginning to catch up with them. Joseph had cried out in distress. Jacob had been all but broken by the news of his son's death. And now the brothers remember, and it cuts them like a knife. It's often the testimony, isn't it, of a child, now an adult, brought up in a Christian home, leaves the family, turns back on family values and perhaps a Christian upbringing, pushes God out of their sight. And then it hits them like a freight train. Something reminds them, a word from a Christian, a visit back to church. Suddenly it all begins to make sense again. That's what happened to the prodigal son, isn't it, in the New Testament? It was that point of desperation when he was feeding the pigs. Well, for the brothers, Reuben becomes their collective conscience. Look how it hits him, the moment of conviction. Look at verse 22. "And Reuben answered them, 'Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you didn't listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood.'" A reckoning, a point of account. They realize that they are accountable for the crime that they've caused. At this point, both the horizontal, the sin against Joseph, and the vertical, the fact that they're accountable to God, is in view. Anyway, they're sent back to their father in Canaan, and it should have been a relatively easy bit of trading. I mean, it's not that hard buying grain, at least it shouldn't be. And yet, the whole thing's turned into a bit of a nightmare because Joseph has put Simeon in prison to sort of hold him as a bit of a ransom, and he's told the rest of the brothers who are going to return that he'll only be released if they bring back Benjamin. And they know that that's not going to go down very well with their father. And to make matters really, really bad, on the way home, they open up their sacks, and what do they find? They find the money that they'd used to buy the grain has been returned to their sacks. And they know that that makes them look like thieves in Joseph's eyes. They are worried. Look at their collective outburst at the end of verse 28. What is this that God has done to us? Well, now the vertical is very clearly in view at this stage, although perhaps it's the fear of Joseph that's particularly driving their words. The implied point, nevertheless, nothing is hidden from God. They get back to their father, And he makes it very clear that Benjamin will not go. Benjamin will stay with me. It helps to remember at this point, of course, that Jacob and his family were always a dysfunctional family. It's not like they ever lived a particularly normal life. Jacob had had two wives, Leah, Rachel, and he didn't really like his first wife, which is pretty outrageous. He only really liked his second wife, Rachel. And his second wife, Rachel, had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. Rachel was dead by this stage in the story, and as far as Jacob was concerned, Joseph was dead. Only Benjamin remained. Only Benjamin reminded him of his favorite wife. There's all of that going on. That's why Jacob doesn't want to let go of Benjamin. However, needs must. Famine, death, food runs out, no choice. Back to Egypt with Benjamin they go. And as the story continues, they arrive back in front of Joseph, and Joseph, still in disguise, puts the ultimate test before the brothers. Here's the opportunity. Given the chance this time, would they show the same hatred to Benjamin as they had shown to him, to Joseph? Well, let's pick up the story. Flick forward to chapter 43, verse 26. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present that they had with them and bowed down to him to the ground. And he inquired about their welfare and said, "Is your father well? The old man of whom you spoke, is he still alive?" And they said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive." And they bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. Do you see the fulfillment again, the dreams? Just in case we've forgotten a chapter on, God is in control. God's got this. Have a look at verse 29. And he, that is Joseph, lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? God be gracious to you, my son." They share a meal. And Joseph goes out of his way to show favor to Benjamin, just like his father had done to him. Do you remember Jacob? The father had given Joseph that special multicolored coat. Well, now here is Joseph showing the same favor to Benjamin to see how the brothers respond. At the end of chapter 43, Benjamin is given five times as much food as the brothers. I mean, can you imagine the brothers sitting together and seeing the little one getting five times as much food? It's how to wind them up. So they get, you know, a couple of sort of lamb chops and a side of couscous is given to all the brothers. And then Benjamin's plate comes in. The lamb chops are piled high, 10 of them. And not just a side of couscous, sort of plates of meze all around him, whatever they ate in those days. You see, the brothers were given the reason, the opportunity to be green with envy, especially given the backdrop, it's famine. Would history repeat itself or not? Well, no. They look like changed men. Look at the last few words of chapter 43. Look how it ends, right at the end of 43. "And they drank and were happy with him." Change lives. But is it genuine, or is it just a show to sort of get the whole thing moving on? Chapter 44, Joseph decides to test them again. It's almost unbelievable. Testing them again. This is like the sort of government COVID policy. Once again, they're in there. And the brothers, all 11 of them, on their way back home with food this time. Unknown to the brothers, though, Joseph instructs his steward to plant his special cup in Benjamin's bag. He refers to it as his cup of divination. I think that's all part of his sort of disguise. And the brothers, well, they're a day or so out of Egypt. They get stopped. They get questioned about the missing cup. And Judah is so confident, there's no way any of us would have stolen your cup, so confident that he says, 44, verse 9, "Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants." The sacks are unloaded, and before long, to everyone's horror, Benjamin is found with the cup. And again, we're asking as readers, what are the brothers going to do? The brothers have every opportunity at this stage to hang Benjamin out to dry, especially as Joseph lets all of them off the hook. And he just claims Benjamin. He says, "Look, you guys can all go. I just want him. He's the guilty one." Well, it would be very fitting for the brothers to allow that to carry on. But look at what Judah says. Judah jumps to Benjamin's aid. He demonstrates that he really is a changed man. He delivers a long and eloquent, heartfelt appeal for the life of Benjamin. Let's just turn to the climax. Here's Judah speaking, 44, so chapter 44, verse 33. "Now, therefore," he concludes, "please let your servant," that's himself, "remain instead of the boy," that's Benjamin, "as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." Well, this really is a changed life. Judah offers his life for Joseph. Offers his life. I mean, this is the first time in the Bible narrative that a human being has offered his life for another. And in Judah, we get a picture of the work that God does in someone, bringing them to their knees before the Christ figure, Joseph. Judah, acutely aware of his sin, acutely aware that he deserves judgment, convicted of his guilt. "Take me," he says. "My life is forfeit." Well, that acts as a trigger for Joseph. It's enough. He recognizes it's genuine, wholehearted change life. Judah, it's a wonderful picture, isn't it? Once self-serving, now self-sacrificing. A picture of repentance, of transformation. And so for Joseph, it's time to remove the disguise, and it's time for the party, the big family reunion, to begin. I love the way all the details are planned out. You see, it was God who planned for Joseph to be sent on ahead of the brothers to protect them, to save them, to make them the people that God would have them be. It is God and God alone who saves. God is at work for his people despite the chaos. And so, what does all this do for us as readers? All of this contributes to our understanding of God, and I think it's there to give us tremendous confidence in God. Joseph makes that clear as he credits all of this, not to himself, but to God. Just look at 45 verse 7 again with all the story fresh in your mind. "God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." Do you remember, it's not our responsibility. It's God's responsibility. Not a little bit of me and mostly God. It's all God. Whatever chaos we see in our world, our confidence needs to be placed firmly in our Lord God. I think that's a very helpful thing for us at this stage of life in London. I mean, especially as we emerge from COVID. I think a few years ago, as we went into COVID, there was all sorts of anticipation and opportunity that we thought we might have through the sort of the increased reach of sort of services online in lockdown and all these people that would now have easy access to church. I think a lot of that has pretty much vanished. Working from home that carries on at the moment, not officially but in practice, it seems to work against evangelistic opportunities, certainly around the city. And all these problems, they're good things to be trusting God with at this stage, aren't they? Remember, this is the opening book of the Bible. God wants us to see that when it comes to the mission of converting people, of bringing a people for himself, God is in control. He'll do it. He will bring his people. It can often look like God isn't doing anything. Think of the situation at your school or perhaps in your office. It can easily look like God doesn't care and God doesn't know. Think of the perspective right now as we end this story today. Think of the perspective that Jacob had. Remember, Jacob is still in the so-called promised land at this stage, starving. The brothers are enjoying a feast, all of his sons. Well, all he has at this stage are the promises. He can't see the perspective that we can enjoy as readers and see how God is at work. And it often feels like that, doesn't it? It can feel dry, devoid. God gives life. And he will graciously put us in situations along the way which cause his people to repent and to change. But here's the underlying application, just for us to finish with. You can't hide from a God like this. You see, there's nothing that you've done in your life that God isn't aware of. We are accountable to a God who knows and sees all, everything. Nothing is hidden. I don't know, maybe through all of this, I think this is how the story functions. It is designed in some senses like a mirror to expose hypocrisy and guilt. Like the brothers, perhaps we've been reminded that there is an issue to sort out. It may be something relatively superficial on the horizontal, something with a Christian brother or sister. More seriously, it may be something before God that needs to be put right. Well, today would be a good day to do that.